Okay, so we're talking about community right now in the series, The Purpose of Life. And I think, you know, each of us belongs to multiple communities. We have family, there's people we work with, we're here at YAF. Maybe several of you belong to a community that's organized around an interest that you have. And the thing is, when we're in community with other people, conflicts are going to occur. And we are going to be hurt. We are going to hurt other people, whether we mean to or not. But it's how we handle this kind of conflict and hurt that can really impact the strength and the health of the communities that we belong to. So tonight, we're going to look at this aspect of being in community, which is considering this question, how do we handle being hurt by other people, especially when we feel like it was undeserved and unjust? Okay? Proverbs 21:15 says, "The exercise of justice is joy for the righteous." Human beings have a hardwired desire to see the fulfillment of justice. I have a good friend who recently had a chance to accompany a friend of hers to the sentencing of a San Jose swim coach trial. His name is Andrew King. You may have read about this in the papers. He molested several girls from the ages of 10 to 17 over a period of 31 years. And I guess he was a really good coach. Girls would approach him with Olympic dreams, and they thought, wow, this is the guy who's going to take me to the Olympics. And the judge said that this was one of the worst cases he'd ever seen in his life because this guy has absolutely no remorse for the crimes that he perpetrated against these women. After numerous delays, he was finally sentenced in January of this year to 40 years in prison. And there is just an immense satisfaction, I think, that we all feel when somebody like this finally is brought to justice. And I'll read you a little bit of one of the victim's comments from an article in the San Jose Mercury News that reflects that. It says, "Sitting in the courtroom with the woman said that she was here for one reason, to see King sentenced. My goal has been reached. This is better than any Olympic gold." But you know, she had to wait several years to see this happen. And many people's lives were hurt. So it's a desire for justice that underlies this notion that if somebody has hurt us, they must pay. I was working with this guy once in New Jersey, and I remember that he was telling me, "Oh, I just got this new car." And I said, "Oh, that's really nice." And he said, "Yeah, but it's already got all these dings on the side of it." And I said, "Really? Why?" He said, "You know, when people park next to you, they open their car door, they're not careful." He goes, "You know, I hate it." I said, "Yeah, I know, I hate when that happens." He goes, "Last time that happened, I was so mad, I took my key and I just ran it across the side of that guy's car and I just walked away." And I'm like, "Really?" I was talking to another friend several years ago, and I guess there was a big sale at Stanford Mall, and she's like in the parking lot looking for a spot to open up in the parking lot, and finally one opens up, so she drives over there, she's going to get it, and then out of nowhere, this other woman comes from the other side, driving the wrong direction, and zips right in and steals the spot. This happens, right? I said, "Oh, I hate it when that happens." She goes, "I know." She goes, "You know what I did?" I said, "What?" She said, "I got out of my car and I followed her into the store and I just walked around the store glaring at her." I was like, "Really?" She goes, "I wanted her to think I was going to do something to her. I wasn't going to do anything to her, but I wanted her to think I was going to do something to her." I was like,
"You've got some scary friends."
I was like, "Wow." So last summer I was flying to Chicago. This was some friends of mine. And I get to Minneapolis, because that's where I'm connecting to my flight to Chicago. And I get there and realize, oh, it's canceled. My flight out of Minneapolis is canceled. So I do what you're supposed to do. You look at the monitors. You go to, like, the next, you find the next flight out of there, and you go to that desk, and you try to get on that flight. So I did that. Run over there. I'm, like, number four in line behind three business kind of guys. And I'm like, okay, so we're all waiting. And the line's taking forever. Nothing's happening. Just waiting and waiting and waiting. Finally, the guy in front of me doesn't say a word to me. But he's looking all agitated, and he takes out his phone, and he kind of walks off. So I figure, okay, he's figuring that he can make more progress by calling somebody or working it through the phone, or he's not going to wait in this line anymore. 20 minutes later, the line hasn't moved, so we're still, like, standing there. He comes back. I guess he hasn't made much progress, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Oh, I was here. I'm getting back into line." And I just kind of looked at him like, "Really?" And he's like, "Oh, you know, I just had to make a call, and I can't stand up and talk on my phone at the same time." I'm like, so I'm thinking, do I want to get in a fight with this guy? I'm a Christian. No. So I'm like, fine, whatever. So he gets in the line. Finally, the line moves. he gets the last seat on the next flight out.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, ah. So I'm on the next flight after that, 3 hours later, so I'm thinking, I know Shannon's probably been to Minneapolis Airport. It's a square. So I'm like, I'm going to walk around the square then, just for a while. So I'm walking around the square. And I notice this guy's following me. It's like he wants to talk to me. I'm like, why is he trying to talk to me? Does he feel bad about what he's done? He's just chit-chatting, like, oh, so where are you going? And la, 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 la. I'm thinking, dude, I don't want to talk to you. You took my seat. I mean, I'm thinking this. And I just ducked into one of those side stores and just lost him. I'll talk more about that later. How about you? How would you feel if you come home, you're tired, you get there and you see that there's a huge mess that your roommate has left in the kitchen, and it's not just the first time it's happened? Or you go to work someday and you find out that a coworker has stolen one of your ideas or is taking credit for something that you did? Or how about you have a friend and you find out later on that they had some kind of party and you were invited and you'd always made it a point to include them? I think when those kinds of things happen, in our minds a red flag goes up and we say, wow, that's so unfair, and our hearts cry for justice. The problem is justice doesn't happen quickly all the time. And so we kind of fall into this temptation to want to make it happen. And when we take that into our own hands and we take justice in our own hands, that's when this kind of right desire for justice can go wrong. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight, which is Psalm 69. We're going to look at David's cry for justice in response to his situation of extreme injustice. So, in structure, the psalm is not, it's a lot like the other psalms, and I know we did a series on psalms about a year ago with Scott, and usually the psalm starts with the psalmist is in crisis, and they kind of move through periods of despair and lamenting to God, and then crying out and asking God to save them, and eventually they get into a new orientation, and they praise God. This psalm is a little bit different. It has those elements, but in the middle of it is embedded this 6 verses of a curse, where David is just so angry at his enemies, he's cursing them. And we're going to look at that and how that relates to cry for justice. And I'm going to just have the verses up here. I like the Net Bible translation that Paul introduced me to a year ago, because I think for this psalm, it's a little plainer and grittier. It's not all, like, flowery. You know,
what was the translation?
It's called the Net Bible. It's online. It has a lot of notes. It's kind of fun. But for this particular psalm, it just fits the mood. So I'll start out with David in crisis. I'll read the first 4 verses. Deliver me, O God, for the water has reached my neck. I sink into the deep mire where there is no solid ground. I am in deep water, and the current overpowers me. I am exhausted from shouting for help. My throat is sore. My eyes grow tired of looking for my God. Those who hate me without cause are more numerous than the hairs on my head. Those who want to destroy me, my enemies for no reason, outnumber me. They make me repay what I did not steal. This is David's situation. He has numerous enemies who want to kill him. He's suffering unjustly. It's undeserved. It's unfair. He tells us there's no reason. And worse yet, for David's position, he's God's anointed. He's going to be the king. I mean, this is not the kind of treatment that he would expect. But David doesn't give in to the temptation to retaliate against his enemies or to make them pay. He handles it in a different way, a better way, and we're going to look at that today and pull out 4 things that we can learn from the way that David handled his situation that we can apply to our own lives when we are in a situation where somebody has hurt us and we are tempted to fight back. The first principle is that David completely depends on God. His dependence on God is a theme that runs through the entire psalm. We're going to see that at the beginning of the psalm, God is the first place that he goes in his desperation. God is the first place he goes to pour out his pain in great detail. We're going to see in the middle, with the curse, God is where he goes when he's angry. And at the end, God is the one that he ends up praising for delivering him. So God is always at the center of David's consciousness. David has brought God into the center of his situation. Okay, so let's see where he goes next. He says, "Oh God, you are aware of my foolish sins. My guilt is not hidden from you. Let none who rely on you be disgraced because of me, O sovereign Lord and King. Let none who seek you be ashamed because of me, O God of Israel. For I suffer humiliation for your sake and am thoroughly disgraced. My own brothers treat me like a stranger. They act as if I were a foreigner. Certainly zeal for your house consumes me. I endure the insults of those who insult you. So. This is the second thing we see from David, is that he does not fall into becoming self-righteous. He says, God, you're aware of my foolish sins. My guilt is not hidden from you. He's aware that he's not perfect. He has sins, he has guilt, and God knows what those are. But he is acknowledging that the situation he's in with these enemies is not justified. So why is he suffering? I'm going to go back one time. He's suffering for the sake of God, for his Lord. He's more concerned about God's reputation, being a bad witness for God. He doesn't ever want to bring shame to his Lord. So I had to think about, wow, this is David's response. What is my response to injustice? I think that one of the first things I think when somebody hurts me and it's undeserved is, wait a minute, I don't deserve this. I haven't done anything wrong. I didn't do anything to that person. Why did they do that to me? Very easy to slip into self-righteousness and say, you know what, I am right, and that person is wrong. But the self-righteousness focuses on me, takes me away from God. And the danger of that attitude is it propels me towards wanting to retaliate against that person and being justified in doing so, which I'm not. So here's my confession. I frequently curse other drivers. You know, I feel like with driving, the offense is clear. We all went to the DMV. We all read the same book. We all filled in the bubbles and took the same test. We all agreed on the rules of the road, right? We're all supposed to follow those. So when somebody cuts me off or doesn't yield, they have definitely done something wrong, right? Definitely. So that is where this self-righteousness just emerges. Of course, when I make a mistake on the road, and I do, I'm deserving of grace because I was looking for my cell phone headset, and that was a law-abiding thing that was happening, and I'm sorry that I cut you off. Demand justice from other people. So, but David did not fall into that self-righteousness. Okay, so, yeah. Thanks, Joel. Let's see where he goes next. He pours out his pain. He says, I weep and refrain from eating food which causes others to insult me. I wear sackcloth, and they ridicule me. Those who sit at the city gate gossip about me. Drunkards mock me in their songs. He continues. He says, you know how I am insulted, humiliated, and disgraced. You can see all my enemies. Their insults are painful and make me lose heart. I look for sympathy, but receive none. For comforters, but find none. They put bitter poison into my food, and to quench my thirst, they give me vinegar to drink. This is the third thing that we can see from David's examples, that he fully engages with the pain that his enemies have caused him. He felt his pain acutely, and he shared it with God in great detail. I think as Christians, we don't often want to engage with the pain, especially when somebody else has hurt us. And it's very easy for us to move into some form of denial, because it isn't nice for us as Christians to not immediately turn the other cheek when somebody wounds us. I think that we feel a lot of pressure to be able to jump immediately to forgive and forget. I'm Christian. And there's another kind of thinking, I think, also that prevents us from fully engaging with our pain, which is kind of a Buddhist way of thinking, actually, which is that if I can rise above the pain that this person has caused me and not feel it, that would be the best and the highest way. Another variation of that is, if I were a really mature Christian, this pain wouldn't hurt me. But David didn't deny the pain of the situation at all. He never made excuses for his enemies in the psalm. He did not minimize the awfulness of the things that he did to them. I think sometimes we kind of go, oh, you know, they hurt me, but it wasn't that bad. He didn't try to handle the pain on his own. There's no self-sufficiency here. Crying out to God, because denial and those kinds of things don't move us towards God. They kind of move us away from God. So he is moving towards God, seeking him and depending on him. So Psalm 69, as we read through some of the pain, the description of the pain he's going through, may have reminded you about Jesus. This psalm is quoted a lot in the New Testament, the pain referring to the pain that Jesus felt. Jesus became the ultimate example of the one who suffers unjustly when he chose to take on the sins of the world. And he endured all of these things: alienation, mocking, insults, ridicule, gossip, disgrace. He felt great physical and great emotional pain. And he felt that pain, and we are going to feel that too. Let's see where David goes next. In his pain, this is where he goes. May their dining table become a trap before them. May it be a snare for that group of friends. May their eyes be blinded. Make them shake violently. Pour out your judgment on them. May your raging anger overtake them. May their camp become desolate, their tents uninhabited. For they harass the one whom you discipline. They spread the news about the suffering of those whom you punish. Hold them accountable for all their sins. Do not vindicate them. May their names be deleted from the scroll of the living, and do not let their names be listed with the God. He's pretty upset. So this is where David's pain has led him. He's cursing his enemies to God. This is one of the many things in the Bible that I would call not prescriptive, but a very normal response, a very normal human response to the pain that he's experiencing. It's normal, not necessarily moral. If you were hurt by somebody, I wouldn't say, well, what you need to do next is curse them, because that's one of the steps. No, but if we're honest, this is often a place that we go. Okay. But David's curse is really a cry for justice. He is crying for justice for God's judgment on his enemies. He's crying for justice and for his own deliverance and his own vindication. His desire for justice is a good desire. It's a righteous desire. Let's look a little bit more at this, because it's interesting to see that as he goes through his curse, there is a progression in his cry for justice. It begins with, may they suffer a similar pain to what they've inflicted on me. If you remember in verse 21, they poisoned his food. He's saying, may their dining table be a trap to them. Then he moves into verse 24, may they suffer greater pain. It's a call for more punishment. Pour out your judgment on them. May your raging anger overtake them. Then he's moving into a call for a wider, more total judgment against them. You know what, don't just hurt them, but may their camp become desolate. May the consequences be wider. And he's saying, hold them accountable for all their sins, not just the stuff they did to me, but everything. And finally, when he says, do not vindicate them, this is David's call for pure justice against his enemies without any mercy. Finally, his cry culminates in a call for death in verse 28. The scroll of the living was kind of like a census list of people that were living in the community at the time. So for him to ask for them to be deleted is kind of like saying, kill them. And don't let their names be listed with the godly, implying an eternal death. It stops here. I guess that's the end of it. That's as far as it can go. His cry to the Lord for justice is complete here. But in all of his pain and anger, David does not retaliate against his enemies. Because David actually knows that it's God's place to avenge him. He never actually expresses a desire to personally enact revenge on them. And he doesn't even ask God to allow him to be the agent of vengeance. And he's speaking in the third person in the curse where he's saying, may it, kind of implying that he's going to let God make that decision. This is what he wants to happen to them, but he knows that it's God that's going to be the one to decide. An expression of his humility, and he knows who he is in the Lord. So Deuteronomy 32 says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. This is really comforting to me, actually, because I feel like that means that there is a place for vengeance. And God is a just God, and his timing and his ways are best. David's desire for justice without mercy, where he said, do not vindicate them, he did not want his enemies to repent and be forgiven. That is not God's heart. Okay, that was David's curse and his anger. But David gave that to the Lord to decide. So why is it tempting for us, then, to take justice into our own hands and want to retaliate and take revenge? I think the first thing is timing. We want it to happen now. We don't want to wait. We don't want to wait years like that San Jose swim coach. We certainly don't want to wait till eternity. That's way too long. I want to see it on earth, right? The second reason is because of method. I think that when we're hurt, we feel like, you know, I know just how to get that person back in a way that will teach them a lesson or hurt them in the same way or hurt them worse. And we certainly don't want to do it with mercy, with God's mercy. So timing and method are the temptations, I think, for us. So back to my airport example with that man who took my seat and talked to me and be my friend. even though I wasn't tempted to, like, punch him in the face or, like, say something nasty to him, I wasn't tempted to actively retaliate against him. I silently retaliated against him. I did not want to have a relationship with him. I did not want to talk to him. I did not want to be with him. I had unforgiveness and bitterness towards him as I'm walking around the square. I'm like, I'm here for hours. Those are all forms of silent retaliation. That's not our place to retaliate. So vengeance is the Lord's. So the conclusion of the psalm, which I'm not going to read, is that David emerges victorious. He makes one final petition to God to deliver him after that curse. Then he moves into singing praises to God and saying, wow, you know, God, you're going to deliver me. And he calls the rest of the earth and the heavens to praise God as well. So he's moved through his pain. We see that he is free. He was able to move through the pain because he was focused on God, and he didn't get stuck in any of those stages. He didn't get stuck in engaging with his pain. Okay, sometimes we can get stuck there. He didn't get stuck in his anger with his enemy. Sometimes we can get stuck there. But he kept his focus on God, stayed engaged with God. He moved through it. And I think that that can happen when we bring God into the center. We keep bringing God into the center of whatever conflicts we have, whatever hurts we have. And I know that I've seen in my life that he will answer in a myriad of ways. It's not always just some good feeling that happens. Maybe you get a shift in perspective. You read, you know, scripture that helps you to see another way. Maybe you see that person in a different light. Maybe he sends someone to your side to talk. I mean, it could be just so many different ways that God can answer that prayer. But we need to bring him into the center of that. So David is free. He's able to let go of all this pain and anger. He's able to let go of his enemies and give them over to God to do what God will decide to do with them. And that's actually the essence of forgiveness. It's a choice to let go of our enemy and to give them over to God and to leave them there while we walk away free in the other direction, knowing that God is really going to take care of them. So the next time that somebody hurts you or injures you or offends you or wrongs you or because of just their own selfishness or sinfulness, you find that you are hurt or suffering, I would just ask you to consider asking yourself, am I willing to move through my pain towards God? Am I willing to not move into self-righteousness? Am I willing to not deny how much that person hurt me? Am I willing to hold back and not try to take justice into my own hands, either actively by saying something snarky back to them or excluding them or by being mean to them or whatever? And am I willing to take that desire for justice that I have in my situation to God, who is the perfect just judge? Justice for man and for us comes from the Lord. And our Lord really is the perfect judge. We are not. David was not, and he knew it. I think human judgment is often too harsh and without mercy. But God is perfectly just and also perfectly loving and merciful. And I think that we can see that exemplified best in the work of the cross. So I'm going to close with a quote from John Piper, which beautifully shows that. It says, if God were not just, there would be no demand for his son to suffer and die. And if God were not loving, there would be no willingness for his son to suffer and die. But God is both just and loving, and therefore his love is willing to meet the demands of his justice. I have discussion questions. Anybody have any questions?
At what point is maintaining silence, right? So not cursing back at the person. At what point is being silent the better choice? Or are you just being passive aggressive? Like, at what point can you just walk away? Or is that retaliation? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of feel like just forget and forget. You have to continue to be nice to the people. And like, at what point can you just let go and say, you know what? I don't need it. Walk away. Does that make sense?
Yes, kind of. So let me pick it apart. There's a couple things going on in your question. So there's the behavior,
right,
which is not talking to that person. I think that whether or not you talk to that, it's a heart attitude.
Right.
So I think that God always calls us to forgive. Whether we reconcile that relationship is a two-person decision.
Right.
Our part is that we need to forgive them, always.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that whether or not the relationship is healed, if the other person doesn't want to reconcile, there's nothing we can do about that. But we're only called by God to do our part, which is to work through that and to forgive them. That makes sense.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't really answer the question, but it makes perfect sense. I guess there really is no good time to, like, you know, you just, I guess you just, I don't know, keep trying and trying until it doesn't
want to get it.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe what you're trying to get at is if someone has wronged you, you can withhold retaliation. You know, you can say, oh, I shouldn't retaliate.
Right.
Because just, you know, vengeance is the Lord's.
Right.
But then, even in your silence, like what you were saying, you took silent, even though you didn't, this man who with the airport, you kind of took this silent retaliation. So
right.
Then that's, like, so if your heart is wrong toward the person, there's almost, like, no way out.
Right.
Aren't you, I mean, you feel like you're behaving badly toward the person, or either you do something bad or you do something by omission. So where is the...
Yeah,
is
that's exactly the question. Thank you for phrasing it more eloquently.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't think that you're obligated to, like, actively seek out the person that aggravates you.
Yeah, right. You can't fake it either. Like, I'm really still mad at you. I mean, it would take me a while to process through being hurt by somebody. A week, could be a month. And so I'm not immediately going to be able to go back to that person and be all chit-chatty, right? It's going to take a little while. Yeah. That's okay.
So, well, I guess then maybe if you feel tempted to lash out at that person in speech or do something otherwise, or maybe as gossip about that person or some other, then maybe it's better to keep quiet in order to not indulge those things.
Okay, so
until you've worked it out. I don't know.
It's interesting. Okay, so this actually happened just a few days ago. Okay, so I'm in a group of women, and there was one of the women that actually said something to me in that group, and it really hurt me at the time. And it was hard because I kind of was very upset, quiet, not wanting to bring it out at the time. And I knew I needed to process that with God, because her criticism was actually quite founded. It just hurt when she said it. And so I kind of had to think about, like, okay, there's something real there. I need to work through that. But I'm also feeling condemnation, and I'm also angry that this person said that. But I'm in that group, and I know in my mind that I want to still be in relationship with this person ultimately. So for the rest of that time, which is like another hour, I didn't talk and participate. I didn't just, you know.
Right. Right.
Because I know that ultimately I'm going to work that out with God. Now it's between me and God, that issue. Okay, and it hurt me, and maybe I'll talk to her about that later, maybe not, but let me work it out with God first. Ultimately, I know I don't want to cut off relationship with this person. We've known each other for years. So let me finish out this hour we're together, okay, knowing that I'm confident God's going to help me work through that, and I want to be with you soon. So I'm still working through it. Yeah, it takes a while.
What is anger that's considered righteous and unrighteous? Because Scripture says in Ephesians, it says, anger, but do not sin. And in Ephesians 6, it says, we're not against flesh and blood enemies, but spirits of the unseen world. So what's Jesus' perspective on righteous anger? Because we use our emotions the wrong way, rather than we're supposed to be angry at the situation itself and not being angry towards the individual.
So Janice and I have been studying with Lynn for many years, and we've been going through Jesus' interactions in Luke, and it's interesting to see that the times that Jesus was angry was always on behalf of someone else. It was always injustice based on someone else being hurt. So to me, that's a place for righteous anger in the face of injustice. I know that Ephesians verse actually does help me a lot of the times, because I feel like when I'm angry with somebody, it does help to sort of sometimes see, like, behind it was maybe a spiritual component, like an enemy trying to, like, break that relationship, and to realize, like, I love that person, and yeah, what they said was hurtful, but God ultimately wants me to be in a relationship with this person, and I'm not going to let that, I don't know, break it. So sometimes it helps to see with those eyes. Sometimes that shift of perspective can help. How would you ever get out of that?
Go ahead and finish it.
No, I think that, though, one of the big keys is what you do with your anger. I mean, anger is very tied to action. And so the idea of feeling angry, I think I think you can be angry. David's clearly angry at the person that's hurt him. But I think the idea of taking that to God and trusting God for vengeance, I would be less concerned with what type of anger am I feeling than what am I doing with the anger that I'm feeling. Yes.
So I want to make a comment going back to what Laura asked, and that I use different terms. I think about these things actually fairly differently. And so I think in terms of payback, not retaliation, because when I say payback, it's clear that the reason I am doing X or Y is because I want to pay back what I was hurt. Mm-hmm. And so if I am in my head calling the driver who cut me off a jerk, I am paying back the offense. So that is payback. And forgiveness is freedom from payback, where I choose not to pay it back. Now, that's different from boundaries. And so I can say, okay, I'm going to put boundaries is about taking care of myself, is not to do with payback or anything else. Mm-hmm. And a perfectly valid boundary to say, okay, for my sanity, I need to not talk to that person. And God does call us to take responsibility for self-care. And so it is, you know, it's our decision, but there have been, one of the things that I had to learn was there is no shame in deciding I need, for my sanity, to have some space for myself, create some space for myself, and that means creating a boundary which says, okay, if the person wants to talk to me, okay, fine, but I'm not going to start something. I'm not going to initiate. It was a long time before I understood I don't need to feel any shame for taking care of myself. Now, it's not a clear-cut answer, unfortunately. What's my batting average? Probably less than half. You know, but then it's like, okay, well, I don't feel a need to always hit the ball to score a home run in every situation. And just do the best that I can and be prayerful about it. That's what I'm thinking.
I think it's a complex issue. I do agree with what you're saying. It's phenomenal. Most of what you're saying I do agree with. I think that there are going to be cases where God will call us to not self-protect, but allow Him to protect us. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we're not unwise. I don't invite Andrew King to be my kid's swim coach. I mean, you know. So, yeah.
I think it depends a lot on the relationship, too. Like, for you to hunt down this guy to apologize for ignoring him would probably be a bit of an overreaction in the airport, you know?
Right.
Find his name, call the
right.
airline, I need to apologize to you. I silently retaliated against you. Like, but there are relationships where I think you would be more obligated to follow through and have some sense of resolution with somebody.
I think also it's really case by case, like you're saying, because it's like
yeah.
one of those things where you can't just take a bunch of rules, because you have to be in contact with God, and you have to be in prayer about it, because there was a woman at school who, I think I offended her, because like for like 3 weeks she just would not talk to me. It was very weird, and I remember talking to Lynn about it. I was like, what do? I like talk to her? Do I try to reconcile? Do I say I'm sorry for what I think I might have offended her with, and all this stuff? And she's like, you just have to pray about it and see what God tells you about that. I'm thinking, oh, what if I don't hear anything? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And I was driving away, and on my way to the school, I decided I was going to write her an email and just say, you know, Jody, I'm really sorry. Just I must have offended you, because I haven't been talking, you know, whatever. I just wanted to say I'm sorry if it was something I said to you. And it was weird, because I decided that. I'm driving to the school. I get to the school, and she's like, hi, Jane, how are you? She's all chatty. I'm like, so obviously in that situation God felt like, no, you don't need to do that, it's over, whatever it was. Okay. So,
I think in that case you're reacting to something that might not be about you,
right? Exactly.
So you have this kind of
right, but 3 weeks and she talked to other people and I'd be standing, you know, it was kind of funny, like I'm
like, maybe she didn't see you, or maybe
that's what I kept thinking, but then it just, you know, so you know, that, you know, so, yeah, exactly, might have been just about that.
How do you, so point two Oh, point three was David fully engages with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said some other things that we tend to do is like turn the other cheek as Christians, turn the other cheek and like. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So how? What's too fast? Like, I mean, you also said sometimes it's just a matter of perspective. So I mean, a lot of times, like nobody likes to feel hurt, right? So, like I find my reaction will just to be like justified in my head, like oh, maybe she didn't see me for 3 weeks.
Someone else, but not me.
You know, like I think I tend to just justify it so I don't feel like sad or angry or whatever. But how does that fit in with fully engaging with the pain, whether or not it was intended by the enemy?
How does the justification fit in?
Well, I mean, like, I guess maybe it's like, what's too soon? Like, if it's just miscommunication, obviously, you shouldn't, like, dwell on it.
Right, yeah, there's wallowing in it, right? Like,
yeah.
David didn't get stuck. You don't want to be focusing, like, that really hurt me, you know? I mean, yeah. I know for me, I really just move out of, like, I don't want to be in that kind of position of being hurt. It's like a lower position. It's kind of like a pride thing, right? It's like, I don't want to be in that position of where someone has wounded me, because that means that they got me. And so, I don't know, I think everybody's probably different in this. Some people probably wallow too much in that and move too much into pain, and then other people, like, I really don't want to go there. It's a position of not being above, you know, it's really being low, kind of like realizing, like, you know, they hurt me and they have the capacity and power to do that. So I have to kind of force myself to go to that place. Like, sometimes I'll just say, like, that really hurt. You know? I don't like it. But I don't know if it's too soon.
Or what is bad if you do move out of it too soon?
I think if you move out of it too soon, it might be harder to forgive that person. You might find that you're not able to forgive that person. That, to me, would be one sign that maybe the whole process hasn't.
But then if you move out of it, there's nothing to forgive.
Well, you're just retreating,
you're
just retreating
yeah.
from the relationship every time anything bad happens.
Yeah.
That really
so that's a silent. It kind of turns into this, like you just took one step back from that person.
I think what happens sometimes, too, is you can think that you're over it until something else happens and you bring it up.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I thought I'd forgive them.
Yeah.
Like, now I'm throwing it in their face, so obviously it's not bad.
How does Jesus wants us to use our emotions? Like, what's the righteous way of using our emotions? Like, well, emotions to me right now, I'm learning how to process emotions, and it leads to, it's like a thing that leads to another thing. So at times, emotions lead us to have temptations of mislead us from not following the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, what's God's way of using our emotions?
Okay, can't answer that huge question, but I just want to say that our emotions are not always a good indicator of the truth.
Yeah.
Okay, because there's sin in the world. We're going to contend with sin until we die, because Paul says in Romans, the sin is still present in the members of our flesh and the members of our body. I mean, it's something that we have to contend with. That sin has sort of damaged our emotions as well. It's not always a good indicator of what is true. So I don't think that we can use emotions as 100% perfect compass of, like, this is right. This is, you know, I feel angry. This is right. This is, I'm saying, you know. We have to go to God with those things, and we have to take it to Him.
I know that emotions don't really accurately describe truth, but that doesn't really mean to deny emotions, right? Like,
right.
How do we focus more towards the truth rather than just using the things that we quote unquote need? Like saying how Thursday feels like a Friday. Like, that's not accurate. The truth is, it's Thursday. So how do we kind of minimize the emotions to know what's actually going on? I guess from a biblical perspective.
You don't have to minimize your emotions, but do
you want to address it? One
can I give it a shot?
Sure.
Sure.
So, the cognitive model, our feelings and our behavior comes from our thoughts and automatic thoughts that we don't necessarily recognize that just like show up, like they can be in shorthand sometimes, like, darn, or ow, or ah. But they're usually related to something like I'm worthless or I'm helpless. Those are the two big core beliefs. But so the idea is that your thoughts influence how you feel. So if you think, oh, that person just walked by and didn't say hi, they hate me, that might not be true, but it's going to cause the emotions that are bad, that are not adaptive. So you're going to be sad and depressed and all that. And it's really hard to change emotions, but it's a lot easier to change thoughts. And it's not easy at first, and I can't do it. And but if you kind of practice and say, well, what did I think there, and start, like, would this hold up in court? Can I question this? Like, maybe they didn't see me. Maybe they were on their Bluetooth and I didn't see it. Or maybe they're having a bad day or something like this. And then just try to change the thought. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, once you practice that a lot, it'll start making your emotions more mm-hmm. adaptive.
So what you're saying is the feelings may be rooted in, like, incorrect thinking.
Right.
And so, like, the Bible tells us a lot about who we are, the truth of who we are. And if we understand that better and better and better, I mean, that's why it's important to read the Bible and understand, like, what does it say about me and who I am in Him and God and who is God? I think the better we know those things, the more our thinking process is right. And then, like you're saying...
Well, and what you were telling me once that Lynn does is that she will kind of dispute your thought with biblical truth.
Right. She digs down to the root of where your thought process doesn't align with what God is saying in the Word.
Right. And then she'll be like, look, here's scripture that says that's not true. I think emotions that... I guess God gave us emotions, mm-hmm. but the thinking that we have that's kind of distorted isn't from God. That's from a fallen world. That's from Satan.
It's like it would be just indulging in the emotion. If you're angry and you, like, enjoy being angry, like, it's not going to... You're not going to get out of it easier. Like, you have to mm-hmm. short-circuit it.
Mm-hmm. Anger is a funny emotion, too, because it's like what they call secondary emotion. So almost always there's something behind the anger. It's usually fear or hurt, which is a primary emotion underlying it. And often we're not aware of that. So anger's kind of funny, because it's like anger comes, like, secondarily over that to kind of mask the hurt and the fear, because those are just so uncomfortable and painful for us to hear. The anger is like, whoa, you know. Gives me energy. I feel angry about something, but when I'm really wounded underneath is what it is, or I'm afraid. So that one in particular is kind of like...
I think also a lot of the times we cut off our emotions before they've run their full course because we're afraid of them. And we're afraid that if we fully fear or fully feel this anger or something, that's just going to go up and up and up and we're going to explode. But eventually it's going to curve down. That's something I'm learning. And I think to cut it off, I mean, there's a difference between, like, rumination and indulgence and to fully go through its course.
Yeah, to just deny it. There's a difference between, like, denying it entirely.
Right.
Like,
or, like, you get to a certain point, you're like, I'm not going to feel this anymore, I'm going to shut it down. But David, like, engaged with that, and he went through the full mm-hmm. the full cycle. But, yeah, there are thinking types that definitely... ruminate on things. I'm one of them. And you kind of get, you indulge yourself and you get into this cycle that never ends. But there is usually an end. You have to go through the whole, like, they were saying in one of my classes that a lot of people just shut off, right, at this point where they don't get to the full thing because they're afraid. They're like, I'm just going to die if I fully feel this anger. But then once you fully feel it, you're like, okay, I didn't die. I'm still alive, and now it's resolving, and okay.